Welcome to Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. Do you take playing with your toy soldiers seriously?
They're historical miniatures, Chantel.
Well, these nerds sure do. Here are your hosts, Tom Castaños, Richard Martinez, and Ray Winstead.
Welcome back to Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. Remember to like and share the podcast every chance you get. Let everybody know about our show. It brings in more people with more amazing ideas. Support the show on our Buzzsprout.com webpage by clicking the heart and buying us a beer. Or you can go to patreon.com/ABA1 to support us that way. Podcasting is not free. Yes, there are free apps out there. You get what you pay for. If you want any kind of semi-professional sound and a backlog of programming, there's cost involved. And of course, there's the equipment. So we appreciate all the support that we get and more. If your podcatcher that you're listening to gives you an opportunity to rate a podcast, give us 5 stars because that also moves us up that algorithm. We had a really nice push going on back at the end of 2023 with people giving us ratings. Would love to see y'all get up there and do it again. If you've not done it yet and you've listened to the show for a while, please stop in, give us a little rating. And if you want to write a review, even better, but just a 5-star rating would go a long way. We are currently involved in playtesting a campaign system for the Firelock Games rules Blood and Steel, the horse and musket era skirmish game written by Damien McCumber and Edgar Pavon. Edgar was gracious enough to, right before the end of the year, to set us up with an advanced copy of their campaign system, which is kind of a push-pull. We began playing in the British colonial realm with this. We are 3 games into it. It should have been a 3-game campaign, but leave us to us to break that. In the middle game, we actually fought to a draw, which means we refight that game by Edgar's standards. So, first of all, first impressions, Ray, with the way the campaign's going.
I think it's great. It is simple. It's intuitive, and I think it adds some continuity between the different games. They feel far less like just individual incidents that are totally unrelated. Mm-hmm. It does bring them together in a very unified feel. And I think the campaign system overall adds a lot of historical flavor to it. In a game that I think already has a lot of historical flavor. I really appreciate the fact that, because it's a skirmish game, I think it's sometimes difficult to really capture the flavor of an era that you imagine large battles in. And I think the campaign system helps pull you down to that skirmish level. So you've got that historical feeling for that skirmish level.
You know, the authors said when we met them at Millennium Con a couple of years ago, because one of the next things coming down the pike is Franco-Prussian. And, you know, and to me, when you say Franco-Prussian, I see big.
Yep.
Big. And, you know, and the point was, every war, every battle begins with the 5 guys that find each other in a ditch to let them know that there's other people around the corner. You know, literally, you can skirmish any level of game. But you're right, there's games you think of as, and when you say skirmish to me, my mind always goes to like a French and Indian war, you know?
Yeah.
But the reality of it is every kind of war has that pointy end where it has to start, right? Rich, what did you think so far about what we've done?
I like that how it's the campaign's basically a modified ladder campaign. All those missions are up front for grabs. As you have a winner and a loser in each game, then the draw deck for that loser becomes more restrictive. So it doesn't go straight to a certain type of battle, but it kind of constrains them more as opposed to the one that has the free outlook on all their missions. Mm-hmm. And so it does build anticipation with that. You hope to get the right draw, because obviously some missions based on how you draw them are kind of easier to accomplish than others, as we've kind of found out. Mm-hmm. So you hope for that lucky draw that, you know, is an easy win. Mm-hmm. So I have enjoyed that aspect of it. I like the command point system. So I think they're called command points, where the leader points kind of stockpile, and they give attributes to your leaders after you kind of hit a certain threshold. I think we finally hit that for one of our leaders. So that's a nice, interesting aspect. And of course, if your leader dies and you start
all over
again, and you got to start from the beginning. So those two pieces for the campaign have been fitting very well. I think the only thing missing, and this is on our part to do, is to construct some kind of narrative between that links all the battles.
Right.
Kind of do at the end, maybe you kind of write up some after action battle report.
Right.
That would be a very flavorful
that would
to what's
be good.
Going on.
And for those of you that are not familiar with Blood and Steel, there are a set of missions that each side secretly selects a mission, and the opposition doesn't know what the other person's mission is. So unlike most games where you bolt action, a Flames of War, oh, we're playing the no step back mission or whatever. Everybody knows what everybody has to do to win. In this game, you don't. So there are aggressive missions. There are more defensive-like missions. There's kind of intermediate missions. And you see them working around the flank, and you start thinking, oh, I bet they need to do this. But it might be a feint. It might be really they need to capture the middle objective. There's three objectives in every game, but right off the bat, some cards say the objectives mean nothing to your mission. Mm-hmm. So,
and so far in this campaign, both of the skirmishes that we've played, the objectives had no meaning.
It was about advancing to a certain distance or whatever. So as the campaign goes on, as there's a winner and a loser, Edgar's written in that you eliminate some of the mission cards for the defensive player so that their options become more narrow because they've lost. They're on the recoil, So it's a simple mechanism. But yeah, it's created it where I want to see what happens the next game.
Yes.
And thankfully, he realized there's idiots like us that'll fight to a draw. Mm. And now we're actually going to be forced to refight the same exact missions that we had in game two, but with all the fatigue and stuff that was built, we don't get to change the force. We have to do it, and everybody starts fatigued. So it's like just a continuation of it. It's become the old school 15-round boxing match where you just sit there and punch each other in the head. Then theoretically, if we come up with a winner or loser, then it's going to push us all the way into that third objective where yet the cards narrow even more.
Yep.
And we should come up with a campaign winner or a loser. So yeah, I've been super satisfied with it. And it has done that. I want to see what's next.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's made it, I always want to play another game, but now it's made one game bigger than it was. Is
exactly.
that a fair way to say that?
And just another thought on the way the objectives are handled in the game.
Mm-hmm.
I think what that really does for the game is it adds a very simple mechanism for adding a certain level of the fog of war effect. Because in most games, you're on the board and you know why you're there.
Yeah.
And when you're already looking at the other army, a couple of feet away from you, it's pretty much a straightforward thing. In this game, that's not true, because it's quite possible for the other player, the other side, to win a game without doing any combat.
Mm-hmm.
Sit
back and watch the other guy beat his head against the wall.
They can distract you off to some point on the board and go and win the game by achieving something else. And you had no idea that's what they were trying to do.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because I've heard it, we've said it, and I've seen it in Facebook groups and online when people say that, oh, the game, no matter what the time period, just becomes very Napoleonic. And I think a lot of that has to do with a lot of times the way these objective things are set up and the way a game is set up. But I'm going to go a step farther. I don't even think it's Napoleonic. I think it's Red Rover. Because, you know, Napoleon moved around. Maybe it's Marlborian. I don't know. Because, yeah, it does. I just watched a after action of a World War II game last night. And I once again noticed that everybody lined up and it was Red Rover. And it was one of those games where you had an objective and I had an objective, which kind of turns into this checkers thing. You know, I mean, I understand there's occasionally meeting engagements where both sides are trying to get somewhere else, but I think those are more rare than a defender attacker kind of an environment.
This is just me. I can honestly say I really dislike those equally balanced, for lack of a better word, scenarios that amount to just a red flag, blue flag. I try to run across the board and capture the flag on your side while you're trying to run across the board. But
you nailed it a second ago. You can totally do that exact thing in this game if you don't know the other person has to run over and get your thing. Yeah, so that changes that completely. So
you don't know whether you need to crawl up on the hill and defend it, whether you need to, I mean, you know what you need to do to meet your objectives, but you have no idea what the other guy's trying to do.
That's right. I think it makes for a very, very good game. Otherwise, a small figure count, reasonably fast play. Now, we haven't...
That's been a part that surprised me.
The games have turned out to be a little longer thought they were.
We played our first couple of games. I remember we got to them pretty quick.
Yep.
I don't remember us using a substantially increased number of figures.
None.
The first time we played it.
No. I think we're playing exactly the same things we've always played.
We don't have a ton. Yeah.
For some reason, it slowed down. I don't know why. I don't think the campaign steps haven't added much to it.
The first game of the scenario of the campaign went long, and I thought, oh, that's because it's kind of our first time back playing it. But the second one was just as long. But we got into these real slugfest kind of battles, and I think that had something to do with it.
I would agree. I know my first game playing it, not knowing what I was doing, I pretty much got shut off the board by turn two.
Yeah.
And so you begin to learn how to play the forces, and now we've actually been able to tie down British units in combat. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're actually getting the full flavor of the game now, whereas before, not knowing what we were doing, we got shot off the game board really quick, and like, oh yeah, look how fast it played, because once I got massacred.
So in the first game, and I don't recall what the exact missions were, but Rich and I playing the Zulus and Ray playing the British, it came down to the last turn, if I recall.
It did.
And we killed your leader, and that kind of made things sort of fun. I think that's what finally put us over
that's
the...
That's basically where I lost that game.
Yep.
Was I had been fought pretty much to a standstill. Mm-hmm. We were very close to a draw. Mm-hmm. I saw an opportunity to do what amounted to a Hail Mary play. So my leader broke, ran across the board to achieve an objective.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, you caught him before he could do it.
Right.
So it was kind of one of those last great acts of desperation that, had you not caught my leader, I might have actually won that game and avoided the standstill.
Because in the second game, That's basically what happened.
That's exactly what happened.
But we weren't able to kill him off. But
you had beaten me down in the second game. I was then facing losing the game. So I did exactly what I vowed I wouldn't do. I ran exactly the same Hail Mary plan, except this time I achieved my objective, which balanced it, brought.
And I think a learning objective from the first game, you shot us to death. I mean, in that second game, yes, we were peppered silly before we could get into an engagement range.
Right. Yeah.
And Rich was talking about, you know, early on, how the heck do you win with these Zulus? Because it seems like we're just going to stand here and get shot to pieces. But
you had, you know, we went that route of multiple units. I think we finally learned that you hit him with one, he gets all shot up and beat the crap, and then you got to go in with a second unit that kind of eludes the defensive fire from that unit. And then you've got him in a vice at that point.
Yeah.
And that's what's been working. We need lots of extra units because the first one's going to get shot up, and then you cross your fingers, it can still close. Because the fallback mechanism in the game is very easy to accomplish. Just 3 fatigue and you're going back. It's very easy to accumulate that if you're not careful. And so, your guys can get pushed back right away. But the difference, Ray talked about it, between the first and second game is that leader standing, because in the first game, we were both at the point where we had accumulated 3 attrition points and we were going to have to make unit morales.
Mm-hmm.
When we took out the leader, that meant he had no one to roll for him. It was an automatic failure.
Mm-hmm.
When we killed the leader, it took away one of the attrition points, because that's one where you can, in that mission, you can gain it, but you can also lose it if you don't currently meet the condition.
Yep.
We found out later, we thought it still stood. So we might have had to have made a morale break also, and could have, again, drawed the first game.
Yeah.
But when we went down to 2, we didn't have to make that roll anymore.
That's right.
Automatic failure on the British side because the leader was gone, and we were at a point where we were safe. We didn't have to make that one. The second game came down to, we both inflicted 3. We got to the turn limit.
Mm-hmm.
We both had 3 attrition points on our forces, and we both make the roll.
That's
so
right.
Both forces stood at the end of the game.
Yep.
We didn't go the extra turn.
Yep.
Funny would have seen what would have happened if we would have had the extra turn.
Would have been interesting, but it didn't.
And that one's the one that ended up.
And the optional turn end is also a good little thing, caveat,
too,
because you know, that's always been one thing too in a lot of games where it just, the war magically ends at turn 8, you know, and then you're with the woulda, shoulda, coulda. I love that option for another turn kind of thing, because that kind of, you know, the only thing that would make that even more interesting, I'm not suggesting a house rule. My head just, oh, wow. Anyway, but if there was maybe an option for one less turn.
That would be all.
Oh, wait, I thought I had one more turn, and whoop, you didn't. I mean, that could be kind of an interesting play on things. I think back to the way some rule sets, you know.
Like, I think that's appropriate for a scenario.
Right, yeah, not necessarily every game.
It's not really a house rule that you would do every game.
Yeah.
But I think that is something that.
Mm-hmm. You could build into a scenario, yeah.
Yes.
Because, I mean, those are the kind of things you might not always be, you know, the rain shower or whatever, you might not be able to.
A dust storm or whatever.
Yeah, whatever, yeah. Early nightfall, advanced darkness. But so one of the interesting things about this, and we will likely go on and try this campaign with American Civil War figures next, is with the Colonials, with the Zulu Colonials, you're dealing with a force that has excellent ranged weapons.
Unlimited range. Excellent is a
yes.
Versus,
understatement.
Versus, as we're playing the Zulus, no range. Yeah. And even if we do come up with the weird little musket arm, when it's a little tiny unit and they're not terribly good at it, and all of those kinds of things. So it leads to, we have to close.
Yes.
To close. Now, when we switch gears and do American Civil War, there are 2 virtually identical units as far as they're fine. It's going to be a completely different game. And I appreciate that, because one of the things we've talked about before is, well, you know, it's a skirmish game. It could be anything. Well, I guess you could argue once it gets musket to musket, it could be any musket to musket era thing. But between these two, they're going to be decidedly different games, I would think.
I think so. I know that the one we play now, basically Ray's Army's got the top of the line stuff and everything. In other words,
for the most,
there is no numbers. There is no reload action him. He basically gets his two actions to then aim and fire.
Yeah.
He gets to form up with no penalty to him. I mean, because normally when you form up, you present a big target,
right?
Which means if you're being shot at, that has consequences.
Right.
We're not shooting at him, so we're not benefiting from that as well. Civil War is going to change it dramatically because of the time period, the technology, and the fact that both sides are equipped equally.
I'm hoping that we see that Civil War dynamic that somebody tries a charge and they just get shot to death. It was like, well, that was a good idea.
That's going to be interesting.
That was a good idea 70 years ago. So much anymore.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm looking forward to it, which, I mean, doesn't that say everything you want to say about a game rule when I just said I'm looking forward to?
Mm-hmm. Very right? much so.
You know, not the, oh, damn, we're going to do that one again. It's been fun. It's been a lot of fun. And I do like the small figure count. I mean, we got this game on the table.
Yes.
We're not 100% painted, but we're on the tabletop with it
right.
in the time that we said that we would do it.
Yes.
You know? And
isn't it somehow amazing that you can go through a phase where everything just seems to roll off and you get lots of stuff done, and when it comes up on your deadline, you're pretty much ready, and then the very next week, it's like suddenly it's just one catastrophe after another, and no matter how hard you try...
And I'd love to just blame it on jobs, but I'm the only one that currently has like a full-time job. And y'all still have stuff that comes up. I mean, it can be, household stuff, family stuff, whatever. Although, in fairness, for 2024, we've played much more consistently than we have in a very, very long time.
We have.
And now my day job has ruined that. But that's...
So I had a question for both y'all. Did y'all notice anything unusual or just a pattern that played out with the game, the two games we played as part of the campaign series? I didn't notice after the first game, because you can't get a pattern after one game, right? No. That very first play game we did.
Mm-hmm.
But I have noticed something over these last two games.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's a required pattern that the only way we can accomplish the game is to close.
That's true.
So we're charging across a tabletop typically to win this game. And from that, where the pattern breaks down is entirely dependent on his die rolls and his line of fire for shooting, because he can put a world of hurt on you before you get anywhere near him. But if you screw the pooch on all those die rolls, you're going to get skewered.
Put a big hill in the middle where you can't see over it.
Yeah.
It gives us up to a certain point. So, that's definitely been helpful.
So where he positions himself for line of sight, and again, just your...
Yeah, terrain does... At least for Zulu Wars, terrain placement becomes very critical.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because
I pay more attention to it than other game systems.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes. I think they did an excellent job of modeling the attributes of the British Army in Zululand.
Mm-hmm.
They feel very much like I imagine they should.
Mm-hmm.
I have very strong formations that can dump an insane amount of firepower out.
Yep.
But once you start breaking those formations, they unravel very quickly and just pop like soap bubbles.
Yeah.
So I got a comment to that. It's one of the things I noticed in the patterns when we played this game. I think the way I'm approaching it is you play toward those attrition points, right? You get to the other side to accumulate three. They got to make your morale point or morale checks, and they can run away if they fail. And I've seen a difference in how the British accumulate those points and how we of the Zulu in these two games that we've played accumulate them. Ray's army has normally accumulated his attrition points through outright kills.
Because
take our forces, you divide them by four. That's how many. Yeah. After every iteration of that, you get an attrition point.
Yeah.
I learned in the first game, I win games by mowing you down before you get to me.
And
that is all critical.
And your objective from your mission is really secondary.
Yes.
You've gotten most of your points through kills and a minority of your points through your objective card. We as the Zulu are flipped. We've been able to put the three, and we've been able to put three on you in both games. We're getting most of our points through our objective cards because it is so difficult to put kills on the British army. Another way that those units bleed away, I've noticed on the British side, you do it just throughout, you just kill us, right? I don't think Thomas and I have ever had a situation in those last two games where we had a unit go away because of fatigue, accumulating that seventh fatigue point.
Right.
Wait, we're just dead. We're dead way before then.
Yeah.
We're dead after two or three fatigue points.
Yeah.
You can't kill the British to a man because of all their special rules and their big formation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have to rely as the Zulu on getting that seventh fatigue to make that unit break. Because both times we've made the British units break, it's only been one in each game.
Yep.
We got the seventh fatigue point on him.
I didn't think about that.
And so the way we're accumulating our attrition points is two for objectives. If we can't get the two from objectives, we're screwed. Because I don't see how we could ever get two units to go away. We've never been able to do that in any game.
You're going
to
bleed a lot to do that.
I was going to say, he's got to fail a lot of rerolls on his saves for you to take away two units. The only way we do it, we stick to one and we keep hitting it until we make it get to seven fatigue points. And that's how we've been getting
that
to three.
That has definitely been true in the two games we played.
Yeah.
But it's also important to keep in mind that that dynamic has also been because of the mission card that I drew. It was the same in both games, and the mission card didn't require me to do anything but shoot you.
Right.
So I had the luxury of not having to run across the board, grab an objective, or do something else that might otherwise separate my formations. I was able to stay back at my baseline, force you to come to me, and play to the strengths of that army.
But
if I get a different card, we'll have to see how that
I thought
out.
In both cases, your card was, because I think you did the same thing both times. You moved your leader to the midpoint to get the one victory point. It was that Vanguard card thing.
At the
you get
end,
one
yes.
point to get in the midpoint, and if you get to the back end, you get 2 points.
Yes.
So
that was my card.
Yeah.
And in the first game, I tried to move up to steadily to try to get to the midpoint, and I considered trying to get to the back end and play to those objectives. But in the end, I realized that was very difficult. It because of the way the movement and everything works. So the second game, I kind of moved into a position and I just sort of stood there and made you guys come to me.
Very effective because you've got a clear line of fire.
And I think I did a much better job in the second game of shooting you guys to pieces than I did in the first game.
You killed more. I think the difference on that was you killed more in the second game. But I think you didn't get enough to get that third attrition point through outright kills.
Right.
You still only got two attrition points through kills.
I came very close.
Yeah, you were four away from the third one.
Yeah.
So you can get it just outright through shooting. Both games required you to do one of your objective points to get that third. The difference was in the first game, you lost it once your leader was dead. And the second game, he held out, right? He killed the trumpeter or whoever the hell was next to him and couldn't get the captain.
Yeah.
And
but if you had killed the captain, it would have been the same exact thing as the first game.
Yep.
True. But what I'm saying is, in both games, I was able to keep my units together so they very much supported each other in their fields of fire.
Yep.
Yeah. And you had to cross.
Even did charges against us in the second
game.
Yeah. You, to charge me, you basically had to weather
run the gauntlet
fire from, from multiple formations.
All that to say, the way those, and rightly so, the way the two armies work are very different. Mm-hmm. The British player, I won't say Ray because he's played British every time, but you know, in this case, the colonial player can achieve his victory almost outright by ignoring objectives and doing enough kills or do minimal objectives.
Yeah.
The Zulus can't do it through kills, at least that I've seen.
No.
With a balanced force. You've got to get objective points and then, as a secondary piece, get the kill.
It would take remarkably lopsided die rolls to do it. Like, well, he failed every roll, and we've
figure counts. You're again doing a scenario that's not balanced in points.
Yep.
To get that kill ratio, because you can't kill them that fast. You know, with all the rerolls they get and their formation modifier, you're just not going to do that many kills.
No.
I guess what I'm saying is, I agree completely based on the two games we played. But both games we played, I had the same mission card.
Just
luck of the draw.
Yeah.
I don't know that with a different mission card that gave me different requirements, if that dynamic is going to hold up.
And we won't find out next game because we're playing the same game.
That's right. We're locked into playing this.
The mission card doesn't change.
No. Nothing changes if we all have a fatigue when we start. Yeah.
Okay.
So we go into it knowing what our missions are now.
Yeah, that's right.
That's true.
That's right.
That'll be a different dynamic.
And that's going to change things.
Okay.
Right.
Because we both know then what the other side is
And what a lovely, subtle way to make this an interesting so that it's not repetitive or anything else. I mean, it speaks volumes to what you can do. I mean, literally these campaign rules as they're, you know, in their earliest form are like 2 pages. Right. But I mean, we're already talking about all these possibilities, and that's just with one set of troops. Right. If we moved on to musket arm troops and whatever, it's going to change it completely again.
Right.
What more of an endorsement can you put on a set of rules and a campaign system for them that the only bloodshed at this table has been on the tabletop?
Not one single throat punch or leg
sweep.
That's
right. No big dispute. I mean, it's all been, it's been... Yeah.
I don't think anybody's even called anybody a nasty word yet.
Not yet. It's early. But no, I completely agree. I think this is a seriously fun little game.
It is fun.
And, you know, I will put in a link in the show notes if you're not familiar, you know, Firelock Games, you know, Blood and Plunder, of course, is the one that I guess they're probably known for the best. But this is Blood and Steel, which covers musket era skirmish combat. I think it says 1840 to 1890, something or another. I mean, you can do Boer War. You could do
it's
U.S.-Mexican War.
U.S.-Mexican. You can do U.S.-Spanish War.
Yeah.
I tend to think of it as Victorian era.
True, but you can go farther back because, you know, that place that I work at, we've already tinkered with the idea of having some like Texas Revolution era
skirmish,
because that whole war is a skirmish theoretically, except for one or two events.
Perfectly built for it.
Yeah.
But I have to ask, wasn't Queen Victoria like already alive when Napoleon first came to power?
Because they're vampires. Because they're vampires. No, I don't think she was alive, but still. All the English listeners, it's Ray Winstead.
She's just one of those monarchs that
appeared to be there forever.
Like King George the Third. He goes from
Ramses the Great.
Yeah, he runs from basically Hastings to
Louis the 14th.
Queen Victoria. Yeah, so
Louis the 14th. Forever and ever. Anyway, we were absolutely adore this game, and I recommend it to anyone. Yeah, Rich.
And we look forward to giving the update when the campaign comes to conclusion.
100%. And maybe by that time, we'll get Edgar and Damien or one or the other back on with us to talk about how that concluded, because I think that'd be worthwhile.
Yes, I think it would too.
Go get yourself a copy of Blood and Steel. You're really going to enjoy it like we have. Other than that, Chantel, take us out.
This has been Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. Subscribe on all major podcatchers and please rate and review us. You can support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/ABA1. patreon.com/ABA1. See you next time.